I'm Peggy Pirro, and this is Food From Here. Brought to you by Swirka and More, hosting a Veterans Day celebration on Friday, November 1st, featuring a catered lunch and a musical performance by members of the Evansville Philharmonic. The event is free for veterans and one guest. Additional guests are $8 each. Reservation deadline is October 25th. Details available online at swirka.org on the special events page. My guest today is Amanda Bradshaw Burks, urban agriculture and natural resources educator with the Vandenberg County Extension. The Cooperative Extension Service is one of the nation's largest providers of scientific, research-based information and education. It's a network of colleges and universities and the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Here in Indiana, our Extension Service is based at Purdue University and serves every county in Indiana with programs covering agriculture and natural resources, health sciences, community development, and 4-H. Amanda joins me to share some of what the Extension does within our community. The scope of it might surprise you. It surprised me. Amanda is also an avid gardener and a home cook with a passion for heirloom tomatoes. She has some ideas for beginning gardeners, ways to get started that won't overwhelm you. And at the end of our conversation, she shares a recipe for a tomato sauce she makes with those heirloom tomatoes. I've included her instructions in the show notes so you'll have it for reference. Now here's my conversation with Amanda Bradshaw Burks of the Vandenberg County Office of Purdue Extension. Amanda, welcome to Food From Here.
Well, thank you for having me.
It is a beautiful day today, isn't it?
Oh, I can't say how much I'm enjoying this cooler weather.
For listeners, this conversation will be airing in the beginning of October when it will be nice and chilly. But listeners, we are at the end of August right now, and we've had a few weeks of hot, sultry, muggy weather. But this respite that we're getting right now,
it's just lovely.
Yes, and we're all like, we smell fall in the air, even though it's not there really yet. So welcome, Amanda. I'm glad you could come.
Thank you.
Let's start with an overview of Purdue Extension. Let's talk about what it does and who it serves.
Sure. So Purdue Extension, I like to say in the easiest way, is that it extends the information from Purdue University into the counties of Indiana. So we are very privileged in the way that our extension system works here in the state of Indiana, is that we have an extension office in every single county with the educators that are there to serve all of the community members of the county. So that's private citizens, shareholders, community partners, organizations, in whatever capacity we're able to support them.
Shareholders.
The county is who funds us, and I don't know that most people realize that. The county funds our salaries and our space, so that would be anyone who pays taxes in the county that they're living in.
Every county has an extension?
Has an extension office.
Mm-hmm. And your work is as an urban agricultural educator.
It is.
Is that correct? Did I get
it
that
is.
Right?
I do like to say that I'm urban agriculture and natural resources because it encompasses all of it in the county here.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about what that job entails.
Oh, that.
Or tell me a lot.
Right? Yeah, it is a lot. Urban agriculture is, just as it sounds, any part of agriculture that falls within the urban sphere. So that can be anything from hydroponics and aquaponics. It can be the home garden. It can be community gardens, a school garden, all the way up to the larger farms that are on the sort of the outskirts of the city. Those fall under the urban agriculture umbrella as well. And then natural resources also alongside that. So anything from pollinator gardens to conservation efforts, soil health, water quality, a little bit of everything, really.
Do you feel well-versed in all of those areas?
A number of them I do, just with my past history and work skills. But I will fully admit when I am out of my wheelhouse, when someone comes to me and needs assistance with something, and I have a robust number of colleagues, specialists, professionals in their field that I can reach out to when I don't have the answers to the questions that are asked of me. For instance, something that I am not versed in is lawns and turf grass. Mm-hmm. And I get a number of questions of people with issues from weeds to pests to wildlife damaging their yards, things like that. And specifically when it comes down to the kinds of grasses that are growing and the weeds that are amongst the grass and treating those weeds while not affecting the grass is not something that I'm well versed in. But there is a particular specialist that I reach out to when I have those questions, who is a wonderful wealth of information, and I'm able to glean that from him and then pass it along to who needs it.
For some reason, it didn't occur to me that that would be part of your purview.
Yeah.
Lawns and grasses,
yep,
and weeds. And do you ever find yourself saying, just leave the dandelions alone?
Personally, yes. I operate under, if it's green, it's fine in my yard. And I mow it occasionally so I don't get a ticket from the city. And that's about as much as I do with my lawn. However, I do realize that other people have different goals and have a different aesthetic and have different desires for their lawn. And that's part of what I support. So under this umbrella of urban agriculture is also horticulture. So lawns fall under that horticulture umbrella as well. And so that is a number of questions I get are about lawns.
And animals?
Yes.
Squirrels,
yep,
and birds that you don't want, or birds that you would like to attract.
Mm-hmm.
You get questions about those as well?
I do. I get questions about animals causing damage or, you know, impacting gardens or lawns or things like that. I mean, we all, I think, fight the voles if we have a garden at some point,
sure,
in our gardening,
yes,
career. But also, yes, attracting our songbirds, or attracting wildlife, or excluding wildlife. Deer are pretty pervasive in the outskirts of our city, all the way to, I get calls, I have this raccoon in my attic, what do I do? And then I refer them to who they would contact to take care of that.
I might have made one of those calls,
yeah,
at one point.
Yeah, and then, or pictures of damage, what is causing this, or why is this happening? And, you know, usually I can pinpoint it relatively easy, but again, if I can't, I reach out to somebody who's more of a specialist than I am.
When I was looking at the main Purdue Extension website and then into the counties, I saw that it was described as a national network of colleges and universities and the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So it's a big network of resources, and it's nationwide and it's county-based. So it's wide and it's deep, and it seems, I mean, that's a wonderful thing. And it's also, how do you filter that knowledge down to the individual level? The small scale farmer, for example, in Vandenberg County, how do you help somebody find the answers that they want?
That is an excellent question. And it is something that I pride myself in being able to do. So while I may not know all of the answers to all of the questions, I have the knowledge base to find those resources, to curate the log of information that would be most helpful while excluding the things that are maybe the background noise that aren't as curated as they need to be to get to the point of what we would consider success. But it also is profoundly impactful that this wide, amazing network of information is at my fingertips and the fingertips of any extension agent, really. And if someone's coming to me with a question, it's because they aren't maybe sure of the starting point, and I can start there with them.
Yes.
And I can ask the questions that get them to that answer probably more effectively than if they are just sort of, you know, Googling,
right,
how do I make my tomatoes grow or something,
yeah,
like that. And then along with the research and the information is the idea that this is Indiana-based. So particularly with Purdue's research, it's based here in Indiana, so it takes into account our weather patterns, our soils, you know, all of the idiosyncrasies that come with our state, and then narrows that down a little bit more, and then sends that information out in newsletters and bulletins and things like that that I see. So then I'm aware of something maybe before the home gardener or the local farmer is even seeing it, that it's been noted that, hey, we're seeing higher levels of aphids this year, for instance, or something like that. Or if the drought conditions are worsening, those are being monitored, and I see that before someone comes to me and says, you know, why are my hydrangeas browning or things like that.
Yeah, it's a lot to keep up with.
It is. It's such a dynamic job. It's such a dynamic role within the community. And one of my greatest pleasures of my job is coming into my office in the morning and seeing the emails from community members, because, or the voicemails. And sometimes it's samples left on my desk. If I've been gone the day before, someone's come in the office and dropped off something with a question. And then looking at that question or that sample and finding the mystery and then finding the answer. I love doing that. It's like putting the pieces of a puzzle together.
Yes, I can imagine that would be really challenging and satisfying.
It is. And every time I do it, I learn a little more. It sticks in my brain a little better. So, and every year there's always a theme of things that are being seen by the people of the community or gardeners or farmers. And so I'll get a lot of repeat questions because everyone is seeing the same pest load or the same issues or having the same struggles. So the community, by asking me questions, is actually helping the community around them.
So give me an example of something that you might come in and find on your desk and have to track down and figure out.
So a lot of it is plants. People want to know the identification of a plant. I tend to get a lot of tree leaves that are browning for whatever reason. And those are my favorite. My background's in forestry. But I think probably the most common is weeds. A weed that has come in and it's hard to deal with or it's taking over. And a lot of times that'll be adjacent to agriculture. So maybe they are resistant to herbicides. And so folks are struggling to try and keep them from overtaking their yards. But then the identification is the first step in looking at the management of that.
Can you think of a weed that you've recently had to figure out what it was or how to deal with it?
Yeah. So someone brought in a small plant that looked vaguely familiar. And I'm looking at it and I'm looking at it. And it took, and I'm looking at it, and I knew what it was. And I took a picture of it and actually sent it to a colleague. And I was like, do you know what this is? And she came back and she said, is that Lespediza? And I said, that's what it is. I know what that is.
So okay, I don't know what that is.
So Lespediza is it's an invasive plant. It's really pervasive in our area because it's used in mine reclamation areas. It was planted after they would come in and strip the land and it would be bare. And Lespediza does really, really well on bare soil, as all invasives do. But it also, it does actually bring nutrients from the atmosphere into the soil. So it does remediate the soil to some degree, but then it spreads pervasively. It is all over bluegrass. If you've ever been out there, mm-hmm. It's all over around there. You'll see it along roadways. You'll see it along agricultural fields. And then it'll come into yards, obviously, because this person brought it in. But it's got a woody stem, and so it's harder to treat than something like a grass that's not woody. So if you're using Roundup or glyphosate, it's not going to affect it. And also, you're probably impacting your grass if you're doing that, mm-hmm. if it's growing in your lawn. But that was a really interesting one because it was the first time I had had it brought in as a problem within a yard, right? Yeah. And I'd seen it in the natural landscape for years. I recreate outside constantly, and I've seen it for many, many years, and it's, you know, ubiquitous on the landscape. But then seeing it in a home lawn situation was new to me. So,
yeah, one of the challenges that I can imagine is taking this information and, as we said, getting it down to the granular level where the individual can access it and make use of it. So yeah, having actual human beings involved in reaching out and serving as like resource librarians, in a sense, to direct people toward the information they need and also to give them, what would you say, hands-on advice?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in a nutshell, that's what Extension does, is we bring information and training and skills to the people who need it in our community. So if you're not adjacent to campus where all of this information is living, you can still get it through your Extension office. You know, whether that's me or you're in Pike County or Du Bois County or wherever you are, this information is still available to you. And not only is the information available to you, but the technical assistance is available to you. I do a lot of site visits. I will come out and look at things, especially if pictures aren't enough or I don't quite understand the scope of what the person is asking me, or it's something that I just want to see in person to be able to garner a much broader idea of what we're looking at. So whether that's a farm, someone's boxwoods that they think might be blighted and we want to know, or if it's someone's, you know, tomatoes who are all of a sudden wilting, you know, things like that. If I feel a site visit is warranted, I will do it. And if there is more need to come out and provide that technical assistance, I will also come out and do that. So
are people ever charged a fee for these services?
No. Mm-mm. So the only fees that are incurred are So our signature programming, which I do a lot of education for all age brackets, some of our programming does have a fee, a class fee that, you know, would pay for the materials and the coursework and things like that. For instance, I coordinate the Master Gardeners here in Vandenberg County. And so the Master Gardener course is probably something that most people are familiar with. And, you know, that's a course that you pay for. And at the end, you are certified as a Master Gardener. So, and we have other signature programming, not just that. But so that's the only fees that are really incurred. For me to come out and look at your maple tree, that's not a fee-based anything. If you come in and bring in me a sample, if I can identify it and give you the information, there's no fee. Now, if you want to send it off to the diagnostics lab up at Purdue, which is one of the best in the country, and costs $11 to send in something for an insect, a pest, or a plant identification, I will help you with that, but that would be a fee that would be incurred, is you'd pay okay. that $11.
$11.
To the diagnostics lab. And there's a number of other universities who use the Purdue Diagnostics Lab because of the fee, and the fee from out of state is $15. So If you're listening from out of state and want to send something to them, that's the fee for that. So no, our services are generally for you know, answering questions and helping the community. There's no fee.
And anyone can take advantage of your information.
Absolutely. It's available to anybody. And I think that Purdue Extension, especially here in Vandenberg County, is one of the best kept secrets of the county.
Yeah.
And we don't want that. We want everyone to know about us. We want everyone to utilize our services because we're here to serve the community.
Right.
I think when people think of Extension here in Vandenberg County, most of the time they think of my role with agriculture or another big one is 4-H. I think most people are familiar with 4-H.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about that a little later in the conversation, for sure.
But there's also health and human sciences and community development and nutrition. There's all kinds of wonderful programming and education coming out of our office.
I talk with a lot of small farmers and people who are farming just a few acres or maybe even less than a few acres. And they're committed. They're committed to organic practices. They're committed to permaculture, regenerative practices. And one of the obstacles that comes up again and again is that of awareness. And when they say awareness, they don't just mean, I want people to know about my specific farm. They also mean, I want people to know why these practices are important, what they are, how they're different, and what it means to you as a food eater that we employ these practices. Sometimes we bump up against a sense that people don't care enough. And I don't know, the question of how do you get people to care seems to be one of those unanswerable questions. But do you have any thoughts on that?
I do, yes. And I would agree that that's an accurate assessment of folks' awareness of agriculture and how agricultural systems work. In the realm of specifically the idea of organic and regenerative farming and working within the land as a cooperative and not just as a commodity, I feel that I have seen a turn of opinion on that and a turn of the desire to know about that. And I was thinking about this ahead of our interview and thinking about the people I interact with in the community. And it could be that the sample set I have is people who are already interested, and so they're coming to me with the questions. But from my perspective, people are really interested in learning how to not only understand those practices, but to bring them into their lives. So I've only been with Extension for about a year and a half, but I remember during the lockdown, everyone was at home. It was hard to find seeds. You couldn't find canning jars. I've been a lifelong gardener, so I had those struggles also. But I think people, you know, they were sequestered to home and they were looking for what they could do. And a lot of people turned to, you know, baking bread and like, you know, cooking, making cookies and gardening mm-hmm. because it was a way to connect with nature that maybe they couldn't before or didn't have the time for. And I think a lot of those practices have held over the last few years, that people realized how much they enjoyed it and they got a sense of accomplishment and really, really leaned into it, and that's held over. And then I think as they've moved into a couple of years of experience, they can see, oh, I can also do this and I can also do that. And if I treat the soil like this, then I get that. And if I, you know, plant this plant with this plant, then this is what I see in the end. And then I think that that has emboldened people to move even further. So this idea of wanting to be a little more self-sufficient and be a little more cognizant of where their food is coming from by growing it themselves and wanting desperately these skill sets that they know what they would like to do, but they just need to get there. So, for instance, we held a homestead conference here. Well, it was held out of Newburgh, and it was, you know, open to anybody, but it was for people who wanted to come in and learn these skills. And we had a number of extension educators coming in. You know, we really put together a robust program with a lot of subject matter. And everyone really enjoyed it, but they wanted more. They wanted to do more, and they wanted higher levels of information around it. Ultimately, it was the feedback. And we said, okay, great. And so now moving forward, having that feedback, we are planning the next Homestead Conference to also encompass that, have higher levels of information. And it wasn't just in the capacity of production. It was in how do I restore the soil quality on my site? How do I compost alongside my tomatoes? How do I store my food effectively? How can I incorporate fruit trees? How can I incorporate animals? And how can they all work together? So that's what I'm seeing from the people. But again, they're coming to me for information. I'm not necessarily going to them trying to convince people to care. But I do find when I'm around people who it hasn't occurred to them to care. I feel like when these conversations inevitably come up because someone asks you what you do for a living and then they ask follow-up questions and I can't help but expound the glory of agriculture and natural resource and all of the things, is that it doesn't occur to them to think about it until it's brought to them. And then the light bulbs kind of start flickering and you can see them, you know, mulling it over. And I'm hopeful that those beginning conversations lead into the awareness of the importance of where our food comes from and how it's being produced for us.
I think you make a great point that some of this increased interest came at a time when people had the time. Mm-hmm. The time is so crucial. And the other thing about working with nature and gardening or growing fruit trees, the time frame is extended. You know, it's the cycles that you have to go through to learn. Mm-hmm. It's very different from how a lot of us live now in very compact segments of time. Hard to squeeze in something that requires you to pause.
Exactly. And this is part of what I bring to folks when they're asking me these questions. One of the very first parts of our conversations is always that look at what's realistic. What are your resources? And resources aren't just money or land or items. It's your time. It's your energy. It's if you're home, if you get home from the end of your workday and you don't have any energy left to put into your garden, or you only have, you know, this 30 minutes or whatever it happens to be. Whether I'm talking to an individual homeowner who wants to start a garden or, you know, community group who wants to start a community garden or a school group who wants to start a school garden, that is always the beginning part of the conversation, because then that leads us into not only what's possible, but also what can be successful. And success begets success. So if we see success as we're working, we are more excited. But if we dive in too deep and things are falling apart around us, I mean, as a human, we're not going to continue to do that, and we're going to feel disheartened, and it's going to go to the wayside. So knowing and evaluating what we have available to us is really, really important, whether that's one tomato plant or 5 acres of diversified vegetables. We need to know what we have the capacity for.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you have an entry-level suggestion for someone who just has a desire to grow something, but maybe they only have a balcony on their apartment?
Absolutely. My first suggestion is always cherry tomatoes. They grow extremely well. You can grow them in a container so long as the container is large enough, and or a selection of 2 or 3 herbs. Don't go more than that because we want to start in a way that emboldens us. And we want to start in a way that empowers us. So if we're starting from a baseline of no knowledge and have never gardened before, those are the things that elicit a lot of success that are relatively easy and low input. All we have to do with our tomato is make sure it's watered, make sure the pot is large enough, and throw some fertilizer on it a couple times through the year. And herbs are relatively easy so long as they're getting watered as well. And those can be cut back and they can come back throughout the whole season, most of the time, depending on the herb. Cilantro is a cold season herb that I always get questions about that will only grow in the spring and the fall. It'll die in the heat of summer.
One of the nice things about container tomatoes is they attract fewer pests. Maybe because there are fewer, so, you don't have a smorgasbord for whatever is coming in, the moths or whatever. But they are easier to maintain in that regard.
Yeah, and I think that container gardens, I feel like when folks are container gardening, they're very hands-on. I don't know if that's just my perspective. I container garden also. But I know each individual pot and each individual plant as if they were my friend. And I attend to them, every other day at a minimum. And I see them and I know what's going on with each individual plant. When I had a larger garden that was, in a lawn and it was in rows, and it felt like more of one conglomerate. But I really do enjoy container gardening because I feel like I can compartmentalize each plant in its own little entity and and monitor it differently, I feel like. But yeah, if you have a single plant, you don't tend to attract the same pest load as you would with multiples, just like any other system.
On a related note, agriculture in our country has not been of that pastoral red barn and silo mixed-use family farm of our imaginations for more than a half a century. But that image, it still persists in the imagination anyway when people consider what farming is. And I'm not sure we've really come to grips on how our food on a large scale is actually produced and how damaging that current system that we have can be.
Mm-hmm.
There's a disconnect. Let's talk a little bit about that disconnect. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts in general on that.
Sure. So in my role, I don't typically deal with commodity crops, and I don't deal with large commercial growers. However, I have in the past in previous roles, and I feel like I do have a general knowledge base around it. So you're correct. The traditional mom and pop farm ideology still persists, even though many of our commercial farms are a much larger scope than that. It's these large monocultures, and for a long time, the degradation to the landscape because of these large systems was pretty pervasive. Now, in the decade I've worked in agriculture, I have seen a sharp shift in the impact on the landscape around industrial agriculture. And part of that is the new generations coming in to farm behind, their grandparents or their parents have a different knowledge base. So when they're going to school for agronomy, they're learning about climate change and the impact on the landscape differently than their dad or grandparents did, because they might have just learned from the previous generation. And also, I would argue that the business model of farming is tighter than it used to be.
So
pesticides cost more, seeds cost more, running equipment costs more, all the inputs are very expensive. And farmers are very smart people. They don't want to put inputs in unnecessarily. So that means that they do not want to overapply herbicides. They do not want to plant into a field that's too wet because now the soil does not facilitate the germination of those crops. They do not want to run their equipment to till it if they don't have to. So by proxy, conservation efforts save them money. They're taking on conservation efforts, and whether they're doing it to save the dollar or to save the neighboring watershed, does it matter? Mm-hmm. You know, so, and then with things like with the usage of AI in agriculture is fascinating. So AI can take pictures as a machine runs through the field, takes pictures of individualized plants, and it can evaluate each of those individual plants. And it can tell you, is this the corn plant or is this a weed? It can identify the weed, apply the herbicide directly to that weed, and save 90% of the typical herbicide usage by being so effective. So things like that that are coming into what farmers are going to be using, to me, are very exciting. And there also, you know, is a lot of information that, you know, through Extension or through the Natural Resource Conservation Service or our Soil and Water Conservation Districts that is provided to farmers, showing them things, you know, that no-till efforts can do this for their bottom line. So by not tilling as often and saving the wear and tear on your machinery and the input of paying for gasoline, you have a higher yield in the end, but then also supporting them into that process. So I think that the damage on the reputation of farming has been kind of done. I mean, that there's a lot of information about, you know, how badly it can impact the environment, and it still can. I'm mm-hmm. not saying it can't, but I will say there is a shift in what farmers are doing. And there's also a number of farmers who are doing it because they want to, because they want to preserve the land, because they want to see it thrive, because they feel that there is an intrinsic value and that it's an ethic of theirs to maintain the land in a regenerative way. So I think that that speaks well to our future. What that speaks to for our commodity crops, I personally can't say because that's not in my area of expertise. So I'm just speaking to on the ground and what they're doing. And I think that in the conversations I have with the community, there is this idea, this romantic idea of the red barn and the family farm. And then there's the other ideas of factory farming as the bad guy, quote unquote. And then there's the idea of small diversified farms and working with the landscape. And not everyone knows about all three or any individual one or maybe none of them. But it's really interesting to have these conversations and to share what I've seen on the ground, because I think there tends to be a this sort of visceral gut anger towards what agriculture has done to our environment. And I mean, warranted. For a lot of years, what we saw in the media was, you know, the runoff from feedlots or the silt in the waterways from erosion from practices that were being done on the land. But that is coming around, not only on the ground, but within the ideology of farmers. And so sharing that with the community, I feel, is very important because good, bad, or otherwise, our industrial farms serve a purpose. They serve a purpose not only in, you know, how we're feeding ourselves, but also in the economy and in the landscape just of our nation.
Mm-hmm. It sounds to me like you're saying that the idea that we have to somehow return to a more pastoral idea of farming or a more pastoral practice of farming, that we need to reduce the size and scope of the individual farm, that's not necessarily true or even helpful at this particular juncture, that things are being done within the system itself that our responses to past practices that may not have been as healthy mm-hmm. for the ecosystems or the food that was being produced, mm-hmm. that it's not black and white, that there's not all bad guy, all good guy.
I think that from my perspective, they can exist alongside each other. I mean, I don't know what I can say or do to change the trajectory of industrialized farming, nor do I know how to go about doing that. It is what it is, I guess, is kind of the way I'm sort of looking at it. And I think that the small farming and home gardening, that can also exist in conjunction too. There are initiatives to, you know, take these larger industrial-sized farms and to diversify them. But that's a process, and that might take specialized equipment or a different knowledge base or some pretty heavy technical support, and also the time it takes to get to the other side of seeing the benefit of what you're doing,
sure.
Whether that's monetarily or on the landscape or just the diversified foods that you're, you know, providing to the system. But yeah, I think that we can do both. And I think that, any system has room for improvement. So I think that's probably where I'm coming from on that one.
That's nice. Yeah. We mentioned it before, one of the best known programs of Purdue Extension is 4-H, which Head, Heart, Hands, and Health. I looked it up, so I remember it from my childhood. It's a lot more than just raising rabbits or chicks or growing a nice batch of carrots or
Absolutely.
Whatever. Who's it for? What does it offer?
Right. So I was not a 4-H kiddo myself. I'm from Minnesota, and we had 4-H. It just was not nearly as pervasive and ubiquitous as it is here in southern Indiana. So I was a little bit unsure about it when I first started with Extension, too. 4-H is basically a program that provides leadership and life skills to kids. And it does that through the programming that you're thinking of with animals and agriculture, but also a whole other host of opportunities, whether that's the clubs that you're in or the classes you're attending. 4-H also will come into classrooms and teach. You don't have to be a 4-H member to benefit from 4-H, but 4-H offers educational programming to kids of all ages, and they don't have to be 4-H members.
Give me an example. Say more about those programs.
Those programs I'm not as intimately familiar with.
Okay.
So Megan out of our office is the 4-H program, and she was in a meeting before I came. So I didn't get a chance to pop in and say, hey, I'm doing this interview.
We're going to talk about 4-H.
Right?
Give me the bullet points.
So we have a 4-H educator and we have a program assistant because it's such a robust program here in Vandenberg County. They'll go into classrooms and do a number of different educational opportunities. And it's sort of curated to what the school is asking for and the age group that they're presenting to. And they do camps in the summer and things like that that are really, really, really great for the kids that are participating in them.
I think I saw some computer labs or some classes with computer something or others on the website, which was like, is it not just about farming and critters and
it's
and
not
so
they
forth.
Do tech just, they do a lot of stuff on tech. It's I was surprised as well when I first started.
It was very impressive to see what was being offered, and again, mostly free. Is 4-H just for kids?
4-H goes up until they age out of high school. Yes. So I don't know if that ends at 18 or their senior year. I believe it ends at their senior year. You have to double check me on that. But we do. So 4-H is out of our office, but we also have Health and Human Services, which offers classes and education and training to all age brackets.
Okay.
So everything from nutrition to money to health. Entrepreneurial skills are offered through our community development program.
This kind of blew my mind when I was looking into it, because a lot of these resources go so far beyond agriculture, as you were saying, the health and wellness, but there's a workforce development program. There are tools for civic engagement. I'm not sure what those tools would be, but it would be interesting to explore that. And I felt while I was reading this that, I mean, it's good because life is one big intersectionality of all these things. But on the other hand, it's a lot to have on the plate of one organization.
Right. And that's why, every educator has their area.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm in the umbrella of agriculture, and then there's health and human services, and then there's 4-H, and then there's community development, and then there's nutrition also. And so those areas of expertise have the same resources that I have just in that area. So it's,
wow.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, like I said, I feel like the knowledge about what Extension can do for you personally and our community is, I want to really tell everyone I know what Extension can do and just the broad impact that we are able to have.
Before you went to Purdue Extension, you were involved with Urban Seeds.
Yeah.
And I don't know if there were things that came in between or what else you have done, but specifically with regard to Urban Seeds, I was wondering how organizations like that fit within that network of resources that we've been discussing.
Right. So I do still work alongside Urban Seeds as a community partner. Right now, we are doing some evaluation of resources that are available in our community through a metric and a sort of a pilot program, which is very exciting.
Can you talk about that a little?
It's still in the sort of testing phase.
Uh-huh.
I don't know enough to it
to
speak of it.
We'll have to be patient.
Yes. And when it comes out, it'll be a wonderful resource.
Was there a survey involved with this or am I thinking of something else?
That was the food survey.
Mm-hmm.
That was different.
Okay.
That was through our community development piece, I believe it was.
Okay. It's called Carrot or something.
Yeah, the P Carrot, that's the metric that I am speaking of.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it just basically...
Forgive my confusion.
No, it's okay. There's a lot of working pieces here. But it's basically a metric that looks at different areas and then who serves those areas. So like under agriculture, I would put in extension and I would put in natural resource conservation service and then what they do. And then that goes into food access in this area and housing in this area and conservation. And so there's a number of community partners working around filling out all these individual brackets within their knowledge base. But then I can go pick up this piece of paper and say, oh, I know that this person is asking about emergency food access. Who can I look on this piece of paper and say, okay, well, I've got these five resources I can refer you to. Or someone says, oh gosh, I would really like to know more about, you know, how to manage water quality in Vanderburgh County. Who can I look to? And I can look on this piece of paper and do that. So that's just one small project. I shouldn't say small. It's not a small project, but that's one piece of something that I'm working on with a community partner. Urban Seeds specifically, my heart is always going to land with them because of the work I did with them and how great it is and was. And so, you know, their initiatives for food access in the community, I think, fall right smack in line with urban agriculture and empowering people to grow their food and to know about their local food systems is always part of the conversations I'm having when I'm chatting with folks. And Urban Seeds does a lot for that. So, yeah, they're doing amazing things in our community, and I'm happy that I still get to work alongside them.
On a more personal level, I know you like to cook and you're a gardener.
Yes.
So can you tell me what kinds of things we might find in your pantry and in your fridge?
Yes. So like you said, I'm a gardener and I am a sucker for an heirloom tomato. Mm-hmm. And every year I say I'm going to grow less of them and I never do. I think I have 8 varieties right now in a container garden. So something I always have this time of year is fresh tomatoes, whether I've grown them or I've gotten them from a local market or a friend or someone who's grown them locally. I think that tomato season is the best season of the year. So I always have tomatoes. Something I also always have is eggs, preferably sourced from somebody locally because I do feel that they taste better and I like to support that sort of agricultural initiatives. And also rice. Those are some of the things I always have in my pantry. I can typically make something very, very tasty out of those items. So.
Yes. Do you have, by chance, a recipe that you could share with us?
I do have a recipe, and I have a very simple recipe that doesn't take any measurements.
We like those.
So, speaking again to it being tomato season, this is one of my favorite things to do. So especially this time of year, if you're growing tomatoes or know someone who's growing tomatoes, you might be a little bit over tomatoes.
Hard to believe.
You might have a bunch of them. You're not sure what to do. Maybe you don't want a can or whatnot. This is a delicious sauce that freezes beautifully. So you take a medium or a large size sauce pot, or you can do this in a crock pot as well. Fill it with tomatoes. Now, if you're real fancy, you can peel them. I do not because I don't mind the peelings. But if you want to peel them, you can. Chunk up 3 or 4 onions. Throw them in there. Throw in a handful of garlic, a couple handfuls of basil if you have it, a decent amount of salt, to your taste, I should say, salt and pepper, and then a glug of good olive oil and a glug of either good red wine or a red wine vinegar. And you throw the lid on that and you let it cook until it's reduced by a lot. And you will end up with this sublimely rich, unctuous, just delicious tomato everything that you've ever wanted in a sauce. And if you're feeling up for it, you can blitz it with a hand blitzer or in a blender.
But that'll deal with those peels if you don't like peels, right?
Or if you want it real
smooth, yes.
Mm-hmm. Or you can throw it in a blender. Mm-hmm. But it's good on, of course, it's good on pasta, but it's good on rice. It's good on vegetables. It's good on if you smear on a sandwich, if you've never tried that.
Yum.
It's good over just about anything.
Pizza sauce,
mm-hmm. any of it. And if you make a giant batch, like I said, you can freeze it and then have it, you know, during your holiday meal and have a taste of summer.
Sometimes we forget about freezing when we think about the crops that are coming in from our gardens.
Absolutely.
Sometimes the last thing you want to do in the heat of August is to be canning. It's too hot. It's too steamy. But freezing, you just get some freezer bags and fill them up and lay them flat and let them freeze, and then you can stack them in your freezer mm-hmm. like books on a shelf.
Right. Know? One of my favorite tricks is to freeze tomatoes whole.
Oh.
So you just wash them and you freeze them whole. They take up a little more space.
Sure.
But then when they thaw, the peeling comes right off.
That's brilliant.
And it's so easy. It's so easy. And it's a way to save that harvest that maybe you didn't have anything else to do with.
Right. It'll just get away from you otherwise.
Right. Yeah. And I can just pull one or two as I need them. And
that's great. That's a good piece of advice. Mm-hmm. Of course, by the time we hear this, we will be past tomato season. But people, make a note and and remind yourself to do that next year so you won't be shy about planting lots of tomatoes. Because I agree with Amanda, tomato season is one of the best seasons of the year. Mm-hmm. Amanda, thank you so much for taking the time to come in and talk to us today.
Absolutely. It was lovely to be here. Thank you for having me.
Food From Here is brought to you by Swirka and More, hosting a Veterans Day celebration on Friday, November 1st, featuring a catered lunch and a musical performance by members of the Evansville Philharmonic. The event is free for veterans and one guest. Additional guests are $8 each. Reservation deadline is October 25th. Details available online at swirka.org on the special events page. Here's a note from the Food From Here mailbag. If you're interested in urban agriculture or market gardening, or maybe you just want to learn how to improve the quality of soil in your garden, you're invited to attend the Farm Vitality Workshop next month in Evansville. You'll meet some of the guests we've had here on Food From Here, folks from Evansville Countryside Orchard, Local Source, Seton Harvest, Beautiful Edibles, and keynote speaker Jesse Frost, who wrote the Living Soil Handbook. It happens Saturday, November 16th from 8 a.m. until 3:30 at City View on Fulton Avenue. Registration is $10 and includes catering by Pangea featuring foods from area growers. Details are in the show notes or search Farm Vitality Workshop in Evansville for more information. Next time on Food From Here, we'll hear from Kelsey Gerhardt of Liquid Gold Honey, a fourth-generation beekeeper who has a lot of information to share about bees and honey. I hope you'll join me in 2 weeks for that. Food From Here is produced by Tri-State Public Media in Evansville, Indiana, home to WNIN-FM and WNIN-PBS. Thanks to Swirka and More for their sponsorship, and to you for your support of public media. I'm Peggy Pirro. Thanks for listening.